Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, Tubi Horror Treasures 2. We did a previous episode quite a while back on Tubi and its extensive and interesting library of horror, and there was a lot of conversation in the Horror Weekly community about movies that have been cycling back into Tubi, so it's time to dig up some horror treasures that were missed on the first episode. And just a quick announcement, we're going to be moving the release date of Horror Weekly episodes to Thursdays instead of Wednesdays. Hopefully that's not too disruptive for everyone. Except for this episode, it's going to hopefully allow us to release the episodes early in the mornings, which is where they should have been, instead of like late afternoons or evenings. So if you're a subscriber, thanks so much for bearing with the change. Okay, now we talked in the last Tubi episode about how Tubi is really the only digital platform that even tries or accidentally stumbled upon approximating what it used to feel like to browse a video store and find, you know, depending on your age, VHS tapes or DVDs, Blu-rays that you didn't expect to get when you were coming in to rent something, just something that caught your eye on the shelf. And a different version of that happened for me this time prepping for this episode. And I love when this happens. It really, I don't know why, it doesn't seem to happen on the other platforms like Netflix or Max or Prime Video, just and it should be able to, but Tubi for some reason seems to lend itself to this experience. So I'm going to be covering out of 5 or 6 movies, I got to check my list, but what happened here was I found a documentary with the word dark in the title, and then just going through the thumbnails or whatever Tubi was recommending, there was another movie, also with the word dark in the title, that I was like, oh my God, I saw that first when it first came out, and I really need to rewatch it because I had really good memories of it. But, you know, you never know, like, especially if you don't remember a lot of the first experience. Are you overrating it? Was it just a great, you know, experience in the theater? And then when you watch it at home, it hits you differently. And I'll be damned, I like the movie even more than I did the first time I watched it. But it was just the coincidence, the through line of the word dark in the titles and the thumbnails and the recommendations that kind of led me to this joyful rediscovery. And of course, if I hadn't seen the first movie, really just from the kind of unique title and the interesting thumbnail, I might have just found it and watched it for the first time on Tubi just out of curiosity. I could totally see that happening. So this is really kind of the closest experience you have to, you know, just pulling cases off a shelf in a physical video store and unexpectedly stumbling upon something. But before I get to the two dark movies, I want to deal with the one on this list that is closest to my heart, because it's a movie that I had no idea existed. I feel kind of ashamed that I didn't know the director of this movie, because he's a pivotal director in horror history, really, that I really should have come across beforehand. And this is another Tubi joy, is I haven't had the time to get around to the rest of his movies, but I went through the list and checked out some of the plots of them, and there were a couple that really jumped out to me. I also got a lot of recommendations on the post that we did on the Horror Weekly page, where I dropped a picture of the movie poster for this film, and there were a bunch of people coming on with some really great comments about this director and recommending other movies by him. So now, as a horror fan, I've got a new filmmaker to admire, and that's just really exciting. So the movie I'm talking about has the absolutely spectacular title of Even the Wind is Afraid. It's a Mexican Gothic supernatural horror film written and directed by Carlos Enrique Taboada. According to Wikipedia, it is considered a cult movie in Mexico and has been credited as having revitalized the Mexican horror genre. There was a remake, which I hear is not that great, that was released in 2007. Even The Wind Is Afraid is from 1967. The basic setup of this movie is it's about a group of students in an exclusive boarding school for women. And the students decide to investigate a local tower that is figuring prominently in disturbing and recurring dreams Claudia has been having. The dreams that feature a hanged woman's body. Oh my God, y'all. I absolutely love this movie. From the acting, the plot, the atmosphere, the music, which is incredible. The ghost has a theme song, which is, when you get that right, it's just like, you know, that feeling of when the Dark Shadows theme starts playing or Laura Palmer's theme starts playing in Twin Peaks. This movie's actually really sophisticated in some surprising ways when you consider the kind of ghost story genre. And it's also like really weird in parts, but weird in a great way. It's kind of bizarre that it has a very similar plot in a lot of ways to the recent Paul Giamatti movie, The Holdovers. And then as I was watching it, I was thinking, what is this movie reminding me of? And then I realized it was the film Girl Interrupted. So to be watching a horror film, and this is a horror film, and in the third act, it gets really spooky. So to have a film that is a horror film reminding me of films that are not, but are really good films in their own right, it's just a really rare experience. It's rare in general for me to be watching a horror film that's in the horror genre, like full in the horror genre, and having it not remind me of other horror films so much as other like mainstream, not even like thrillers or dark thrillers or horror comedies or anything like that, like just dramas. The camera work is interesting because it's really plain in parts, sometimes even a little bit choppy. But in other parts, it reminded me a lot of John Carpenter, actually, the way Carpenter's camera would like crawl. Or, you know, I guess the best example of it that isn't Carpenter, but actually Kubrick, is if you remember the moment when Wendy is looking down at the typewriter in The Shining, discovering to her horror that her husband is not a very good novelist, and the camera is moving sideways behind her from what is clearly the approaching Jack Nicholson's point of view. It's a very small, sinister, creepy motion. Well, the camera in Even the Wind Is Afraid does that in a few scenes in a really, really effective and cool way. Another thing this movie has going for it is that it has a really, really strong and memorable opening. I can't imagine, like, there's so many movies that I've seen in the last few years where I can't even remember a single scene from them. Sometimes I can't even remember if I watched them at all. But this movie, even if I hadn't finished it, even if I had gotten bored or it wasn't for me, or, you know, I didn't end up loving it as much as I do, the opening would have been something I would have remembered forever. You could ask me 20 years from now, what's the opening, what movie has the opening of the girl having her name called and kind of like approaching this creepy tower and going up it and discovering a body hanging from the rafters with a shadow projected on the wall of the body as she stares up in absolute terror and fear and being disturbed. And I would have been like, oh, that's even The Wind Is Afraid. So the movie does a great job of introducing us to establishing and then fleshing out all of the major characters. It's really, really good in that respect. It reminded me of Cabin in the Woods, where you really get to know like who the characters are, what their roles are going to be. In this case, it's in a women's boarding school. So we've got a set of girls who are, they're pretty much a tribe. They all get along, and kind of complement each other in different ways, not with perfection. I mean, there's tensions and things beneath the surface. There's girls hunting the boyfriends of other girls. There's longing for, trying to manifest, like, oh, I wish you would leave her and come to me. There is disagreements about the headmaster of the school, who they keep calling Brua or witch, whether she's a really, really bad person or just a frustrated, kind of lonely person. So they're not perfectly in sync, as no real group of people would be, but they're authentically friends. As a matter of fact, there's such a well-knit group that towards at the end of the movie, when you fear that they might be broken up forever, that like because of the events the school might get shut down or whatever, you're on the edge of your seat, or at least I was, hoping that they would get to stay together as a group at the school, even though with all the events that are happening at the school, their parents clearly should be taking them home. The authorities should clearly be closing the school forever. But you're hoping against hope that they don't get broken up, which is, that's kind of like the Losers Club from It vibe. You're rooting for each of the characters, but you're also individually, but you're also rooting for them as a team. And speaking of because the movie takes its time to getting to the supernatural, because at the beginning, it could be insanity, it could be nightmares. But one thing that's happening is all of this, or many of the students, keep calling the headmistress witch. And they're very emphatic about it. And it starts to give, you start to, even though she's not evincing any signs of being an actual witch with supernatural powers, they're so emphatic about it, you just start to think of her as a witch. So the movie sort of has a way of sneakily getting supernatural, at least subconsciously for the viewer, before it actually goes full-bore supernatural. Now, the other characters who are in relation to the girls are the witch. Her name is Bernarda. She's, I would call her the principal, or I think the movie calls her the principal. I've been calling her the headmistress. So we'll call her the principal. Then her second in command, Lucia, who's the vice principal. We also have Diego, who's kind of like the repairman of the school. And then we have Armando, who's the lurking bad boy boyfriend of Kitty, one of the girls in the tribe. We have Josefina, who's an interesting character because she's the group snitch. She's the one who's kind of the pet of the principal and isn't really friends with the rest of the group. She's kind of out of sync with them, and she's also what the movie keeps calling a gossip. So she always runs to the principal and tells her what the girls are doing. So she's essentially a spy. And then we have Andrea, who is a brilliant, charismatic student who had been at the school quite a while ago and ended up taking her own life out of despair when she was grounded at the school instead of being able to go home for vacation, which is what is happening to our girls as we enter the movie here. It's a mistake the principal keeps making, except for this solitary student, Andrea, finds out that her sick mother passes away while she's trapped in punishment at the school. Instead of being able to go home and be with her sick mom, she misses her passing away and she hangs herself in the school tower. And the principal learns nothing from this, apparently. This is like her super talent in the movie, is to learn nothing from her mistakes. And now she's gone full the holdovers with this set of girls. And now they're here for 10 days stuck. And just like in the holdovers, they're not even allowed to relax. They have to go to classes when they were supposed to be on break. The principal is really riding them. And the reason, by the way, they're grounded to the school is because Claudia and got the rest. Well, she didn't actively, but she heard voices coming from the tower where Andrea had hung herself. The tower is supposed to be locked, but it is not. I'll get to that in a second because it's hilarious. And then the whole troop goes into the tower. And a really interesting scene unfolds here because Claudia keeps telling the girls, I see this tower in my dreams. There's a voice that calls me and I keep seeing myself in this tower. And they do not believe her. But when they break into the tower, when they're at the floor, they look up the big staircase and then think, like, you know, the tower in Vertigo where they climb, where Jimmy Stewart gets vertigo, or think like the cathedral in Tim Burton's Batman with Jack Nicholson at the end when they're climbing up and the bell comes crashing down. Like, it's kind of like that look, just on a, you know, obviously less budget scale, but similar feeling. And as they're all staring up there, they ask her, well, if you have dreamt of up there, what does the top of this tower look like? And she says it's enclosed by a red door with a bar on it. And she's like, the door is very old and wormy. So now they're really intrigued, the girls. They're like, well, let's see if her prediction is true, because this tower has never been unlocked before. She can't have been in there. So if she's accurately described it, then she must be having some kind of like weird psychic event. So they climb up the tower to the top and they verify that what she's saying is true. It looks exactly the way she's describing it. And just as their minds are getting blown by that, of course, Principal Buzzkill comes in and catches them and says, you're not allowed to be in this tower. That's why the tower's locked. And now I'm going to, you know, ground you all and keep you here instead of getting to go home with your parents for vacation. Now, I'm going to just quickly go over a couple of things that I really like, or I think make this movie really special. I'm going to try not to spoil it, or if I do, it'll be just mild. So what are some great ingredients of this movie, besides the stuff I already mentioned about the camera work and the acting, blah, blah. So one of the first things is the students in this movie are constantly carrying books around. I don't think I've ever seen anything like this in a horror movie. No matter where they go, if they're like running for their lives, or they're breaking into haunted towers, or they're sneaking around in windstorms in the middle of the night, like, for some reason they're always carrying their school books. It's really odd, actually. But as an avid reader, it was like, oh, they're living in my paradise. Like I said, the camera work is really ambitious in parts. There's a really small moment somewhere in the middle of the film where a character, a visiting doctor, examines someone, gets back into the car to leave. And it's really cool how the camera like follows him backwards into getting into the car. It holds on the person talking to him. They're having a conversation, but the camera's holding on her. And then we get into the car. The camera stays on the person talking to him through the car window. And it's like just over his shoulder. And it really feels like you're spying on them or eavesdropping. It's like a slightly unsettling place to put the camera. And like, I've seen this moment a million times in movies. And, you know, 99% of directors don't bother to make such a simple moment memorable, but Toby Otta absolutely does in this movie, and he does it more than once, many times. I said I was going to get to the padlock that protects the tower. This is the world's most ineffective lock. In the history of horror movies, there has never been a more useless lock. This is now on my list of props from horror movies that I would love to acquire. Like, if this original lock for this movie is somewhere, I will bid for it because it will bring a smile to my face for the rest of my life if I see it on my desk or on my wall or in a box somewhere. And I won't bother to keep it safe because, like, boy, I'm not going to put a padlock on a padlock. But I'm telling you, like, every time you think this padlock is going to come through and protect the students finally, it absolutely does not. And it gets infiltrated in, like, several different ways. And the movie lingers on it. It shows people repairing it. There's people talking about it. The principal of the school, you know, talks about how much faith she has in it. It's just bizarre how ineffective this one piece of equipment is. I really appreciate what the movie did with the character of Armando. He's the only male character that is the student's age in the entire film. He's not in it much. I mean, clearly this is a woman's school, so he's not supposed to be there. They're very strict. So at some point he breaks in because he promised his girlfriend Kitty that he was going to come visit her. And he sneaks in, he's sneaking around. And as soon as he arrived, I've been conditioned by all the horror movies I've seen to expect him to be like either a Halloran type character who is sort of a red herring and gets killed in some kind of like chilling way by the supernatural forces, or he's going to protect the girls. He's going to, you know, like do manly stuff and do like whatever. And this movie does neither of those things. With the one moment when he's at the school, when something actually supernatural, which they don't know at the time is supernatural, but is, when something scary happens, his girlfriend tells him to run away and he's gone. He is gone like a jackrabbit. He is out of this movie so fast. Your head will spin. The last thing we see of him, is him just like vaulting a fence and running for his life. It's amazing. It's amazing that the movie like brought him in, did absolutely nothing with him and then rejected him. And the thing is, it just felt like real life that way and not like a movie, which I thought was super cool. The ghost in this movie is not the only scary thing in the movie. Most of the movie, the principal is scarier than the ghost. She's definitely terrifying and torturing many of the students. And the students themselves can get a little Lord of the Flies. There's a really great scene that is a dancing scene that I take it is relatively famous for people who are aware of this movie because its execution is really kind of B movie in parts and really odd, kind of corny. But still cool. But before the striptease scene happens, there's the students are bullying Josefina, the spy, the narc, into dancing, which is clearly not allowed. And one of the students is playing the piano, which is also not allowed unless you're like playing something boring for your lessons or whatever. This school sucks. And they cajole her into dancing with them, like letting down her guard and actually doing something, breaking the rules. And she starts to dance with them. And as you'd expect, the Footloose effect happens. She kind of enjoys it. She gets a smile on her face and you really start to think, oh, maybe like she can join the group now. They'll see that she can, you know, relax and do fun stuff with them and maybe the tension will break. And then they take it way too far and they tell her that dancing's not enough. She has to do a striptease, which she clearly is too repressed to do. And when she won't do it, they tear her clothes off. And she is just devastated by this assault. Her acting here is super credible. You feel absolutely awful for her. And to her credit, Claudia, the hero of this movie, jumps in and tells them not to act like barbarians and backs them off so the bullying stops. But this movie kind of goes Stephen King's Carrie here in this scene for a little bit. You're getting some plug it up vibes, although in this case it's for a less sympathetic character because after all she's the spy for the authority figures and not just a supernaturally gifted girl being tortured horribly by her mother and her fellow students, or at least most of them. but still, it's a really memorable scene. There's another scene where Claudia, who has gained knowledge that she should not possess, can't reveal anything else without blowing up the plot, is asked a question by the principal in one of their interminable classes and just rattles off the absolutely perfect answer, like Good Will Hunting style. And as she's doing it, the camera is panning across all her friends' faces as they look up one after the other after the other. Like, I mean, if Claudia had grown three heads, they would have had the exact same expression on their faces as they had as her with her answering this really complex question about literature just perfectly. And even though they're kind of joking about it, they're like, the principal asks her, where did you learn all this? And she goes, you know, I read it in the library. And her friends are whispering to themselves, she went to the library? And the other friend's like, maybe she got lost. Maybe she opened the wrong door. Like, Claudia never goes to the library. But what's cool here is, while she's a beautiful minding them, there's also a very faint touch of the sinister about what's happening and why it's happening. And it's just perfect. It's just like the perfect touch. It's like getting your head just right on a pillow. Just that feeling you were like, oh, I can sleep for 10 hours this way. The movie gets it just right in this and many, many other instances of the film. Oh, by the way, in the previous dancing abuse bullying scene, the music that they're playing during the horrendous abuse is the music. I've never been reminded so much of the music from Charlie Brown Christmas. So it's super jarring to watch someone getting psychologically demolished while Schroeder's over there playing on piano. It's pretty unique. The characters here are like strange, but for unexplained reasons. When Lucia goes to visit Diego and tell her that she's afraid there really is a ghost on the grounds of this school, Diego goes, oh no, she's not there's no ghost. And then she's like, well, if there's no ghost, then, you know, how can we be seeing her? She's dead. And he's like, oh, you know, I saw her too. And she's like, what? You saw Andrea? How did you see her? She's dead. And he's like, well, maybe she's looking for something. And you're like, what? You just said she's not a ghost. And it's weird because he seems to have a logic he doesn't explain, which is, she's no ghost, poor thing, he says. So it's like, in his mind, a ghost is like a malevolent force and she's more like a spirit, or I don't know, like he has like categories of the, visitors from the beyond the grave. The movie never explains it, but like one of the things that's really good about the movie is the characters are just like off in strange, just left of center ways. And then at the end of the movie, I'll dance around this because, again, no spoilers, but there's a moment where the doctor we met before re-arrives at the school, and he turns to Josefina and says, will you announce me? And she smiles and says, there's no need for that. And I didn't catch it on first watch, but that's a much bigger moment than I realized, because it means that everything in this school is changing for the better, or has changed for the better. And it's such an economical way for the director to get that across to us. Maybe too economical because I missed it on the first pass. But it's a really sweet moment, actually. So all of the movie is super enjoyable. I personally think it's an absolute masterpiece. It's my favorite older horror movie I've watched this young year so far. And I've watched a bunch, as you all know, but it's the horror of it is really confined to the beginning and then hints around in the first half of the movie and then really comes into its own in the third act. So the third act is really only where it goes horror, but it's, to me anyway, worth the wait, because once Claudia and Andrea really kind of tangle, And we get to know what's really happening. It gets very sinister. And the wind of the eponymous, even the wind is not afraid, is so atmospheric and effective. It's like John Carpenter's The Fog, where take out the fog and make it the wind. And it plays almost a character that way in terms of always being present, always moving objects around, always like building up in force and whistling sounds and a hint of tearing things apart, blowing windows open. I fucking love this movie and I'm grateful to Tubi for having it accessible. Okay, our next Tubi horror treasure is a documentary called Master of Dark Shadows from 2019. Now, I am a passing fan of Dark Shadows. I never really got into it super deeply. I really appreciate for what it is. I did like both the movies in their own respects. I even like the reboot with Ben Cross. I'm a huge fan, obviously, of Jonathan Frid, and really respected it for what it was. But it's such a mammoth thing, and I was never in on the ground floor of it. So, yeah, I am aware, respectfully aware of it, but I'm not steeped in the lore. I'm not a super fan. So I see this documentary, and I was like, should I get more into Dark Shadows? Let's see what this documentary is about. Let's see how convincing it'll be. And I don't know that it's going to get me into it. Not for not being an amazing documentary. I wouldn't be putting it in my Tubi horror gems if it wasn't just a spectacular piece of work. But again, it was just reminding me of how mammoth Dark Shadows is and how little time I have. So, but in a perfect world where I had infinite amount of time, this would have convinced me to really go down a Dark Shadows rabbit hole. When it first started, I thought it was going a little heavy on Dan Curtis, who is the, you know, creative force behind Dark Shadows. Not that I was against that or him. I just felt like, you know, it's a Dark Shadows documentary, and it seemed to start out almost like an A&E biography of Dan Curtis. But it moved past that pretty quick, and then I kind of saw why. And it's because of my ignorance that I was reacting that way. I just had no idea how influential Dan Curtis is in a lot of different ways. I had, you know, read somewhere about, you know, Dark Shadows being, you know, a failure, that it was going to get canceled because it started as kind of like a gothic soap opera, but with no supernatural elements. It was kind of just like Hitchcock's Rebecca on a, like a super low budget at being done as a soap opera for daytime television on ABC. And then he started to introduce supernatural elements in it out of desperation or out of just like a fuck you spirit, because they were going to cancel him anyway. So why not do like the craziest thing you could do? And I appreciate that, you know, rebel mentality or whatever. But it seemed to me, the impression I was getting was that Dan Curtis was like, he lucked into this, and that he was kind of, I don't want to say loser, because that's the wrong word, but like, not as formidable as he turns out to be. I mean, this guy is a force of nature, and he achieved some incredible milestones in television beyond Dark Shadows, and produced just a bunch of other horror stuff, like Burnt Offerings or the Jack Palance Dracula. But beyond all that, he almost feels supernatural himself. He feels like almost unstoppable and sort of like a vampire himself, with like no need to sleep, no need to eat, just like to do the work, to like grind it out and make things. So he's a much more impressive person in creative history than I gave him credit for. Totally my fault and my bad, which the documentary helped correct for me. And then I just wasn't prepared for how absolutely engaging all of the interview subjects were. Not just former cast members of Dark Shadows, and they're all spectacular, and they just seem like such a great twisted little family. Barbara Steele is like an incredible standout. I mean, all of them, like Ian McShane, David Selby, Laura Parker. I mean, there's a bunch of them that were just kind of every time the camera went to them for an interview snippet, it was just so cool. But the other people they brought in to talk about the effect of Dark Shadows on them, like Whoopi Goldberg out of nowhere, and Alan Ball of True Blood fame, who was really interesting in this documentary. And then the history behind Dark Shadows and how it blew up and became as influential as it did was just something that I had no real idea of how it went down. And to think that this horror property infiltrated daytime television, like doing Twin Peaks before Twin Peaks, showing up somewhere unexpected where you just don't expect to see anything like this on network television, let alone at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the middle of the damn day. You know, I think of Dark Shadows as like creaky and old, but it was a huge revelation and hit to young people of its time, which I had no idea and wouldn't have guessed at all. But that was like, it's besides like what the documentary calls the housewife audience, just the teenage audience and the ferocity of their appreciation for this show. It was not something I was prepared for or knew about, and it was awesome to see. The fact that there was like an entire generation of American teenagers who were rushing out of school, running off of their school buses to get into their houses to just make it just in time to click on the first minute and hear that Dark Shadows theme and follow what was happening in the show was just not something I knew. And then the one thing I expected, which the documentary delivered, was just like the greatness of Jonathan Frid himself and the greatness and complexity of the Barnabas character and how it was so revolutionary for its time. Not something that it had really been done with vampires before in terms of making them, like they call him the reluctant vampire. And, you know, we saw that before in horror. You see that with like Lon Chaney Jr.'s The Wolfman for sure, but not really with vampires on film, at least not fleshed out in a huge universe the way Dark Shadows was doing it. And then just like the sheer ballsiness of what the show was doing. I mean, first of all, it was stealing left and right from every classic horror story it could. And, you know, you can't really blame them. It verges on plagiarism a lot, but like, when you watch this documentary and they really explain to you the pressures of having to come up with like fresh live television 5 times a week, the entire year, it's just such a grind and so grueling that the writers were just burning through content at such a rate that they just didn't see any other way to, you know, provide the material to fuel the show to keep it going. But not just the theft, right, but the ballsiness of the storylines, the time traveling, which was insane, and then the veering off into wild different directions with other monsters. Just really, really fun. And you know, to me, it was a little bit sad towards the end of the doc when they're interviewing Dan Curtis, clearly not long before he died. And he really kind of, it was, Dark Shadows became his, it's that song that the rock band resents that everyone wants them to play at the concert. It's Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. Right. Like this is the thing. He was like, this is going to be a thing on my tombstone. But like my greatest achievement was like Winds of War, like War of Remembrance, and like these TV epics that were a big deal at the time. And no one really thinks about or talks about. at all anymore while Dark Shadows goes on and on. But it was sad to see him, to realize that he really burned out on horror and didn't really hold it in that high regard at the end. But it's a really, it was, at least to me, it was a really interesting lesson as a horror fan that, sure, there are a lot of creators, filmmakers and authors and, you know, people who do things in the horror genre that are very passionate about the genre. But there are also this subset of really skilled filmmakers or creators that are not thinking about it. Like Dan Curtis thought about Dark Shadows as gothic romance. He didn't even really think about it as horror. It clearly is, and he clearly was wrong. But it may not be necessary to achieve greatness in the horror genre in every case for the person doing it to be like an aficionado of the genre itself. And although that kind of hurts my horror heart, I find it super interesting that it's the case. Okay, as I said, I browsed over from Master of Dark Shadows to Super Dark Times, American independent film directed by Kevin Phillips. It was actually his directorial debut. It's about after a traumatic accident, an inseparable pair of teenage boys and best friends lose their innocence and sanity from jealousy, violence, and paranoia. I actually really kind of love this movie. It's because it's sort of the photo negative of Stephen King's kids / early teenagers world. It's the grimy, opposite land of the nostalgia-tinged world of the Losers Club and The Body, Stand By Me. It's like the Gen X Losers Club. And that would be exactly as awful as it probably sounds to you, where everything is grimy and gray and, kind of run down and hopeless. But the violence that's under the surface in Stephen King's works, where he's working with groups of kids like this, that bubbles up to the surface, in this one is never under the surface. It's kind of right over the top of it. It's kind of like there's a layer of cellophane protecting us from the violence, instead of like, in Stephen King's lacquered, layered version, where it takes a lot for the violence to break through and then take over everything. Here, it's kind of already taken over, and we're just kind of pretending that it hasn't. The scenes where the violence happens come across to me as really, really realistic, kind of like haphazard and chaotic, and the way they actually would happen. And then the sneaky sort of serial killer aspect to what's going on here is interesting, because it's a serial killer from within. So it's not like almost any other serial killer kind of thing that I can think of. This is kind of like the birth of a serial killer, and it's someone who's in the group from the start, kind of one of the central figures of the group. So there's no mystery. There's no, there is mystery, because they don't know necessarily that he's a serial killer, but we know right away as viewers. And as it manifests through the movie, it kind of leads to the unforgettable, to me, final sequence, which, besides the original fight sword sequence that sets the whole plot in motion, where someone gets killed with a katana. And I just love that sequence too. Just like after getting stabbed, just the crazy directionless running for your life, but getting nowhere, only to flop down and get claimed by the earth. The disposing of the sword in like an Onibaba-esque hole. All of that is great. But It's the final sequence with the one kid finally putting it all together, realizing what's happening, and running faster than you would run to save your own life to go save someone he cares about. Just the most motivated running outside of a Tom Cruise action movie that you'll see in a film. And this kid's running, and you're just like wanting to push him faster. You wanting to pick him up like Neo flying the Matrix style and just like teleport him over to where he's trying to get to. Cause you can see it on his face that he knows he's going to be too late. And he is too late. Well, mostly too late. And it's awful, but it's absolutely just such a gloriously shot sequence between the realness of the violence, the absolute confusion of the characters, the unexpected dialogue from the characters, where you've got someone trying to kill someone 1 second and then telling him he's his best friend in the other second. The casual way that the serial killer is handing the weapon to his victims to inspect and play with, where you kind of, he feels like that he's doing the Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men flipping a coin thing, but he's doing it in his head. Like, am I going to kill them? Am I not going to kill them? You can tell that it's like something that he would grow into as a more controlled serial killer later if he got there. But right now he's too young. He's too much of a mess. He's too impulsive. He's too broken as well. And he's also just too evil, like with no empathy to stop him from doing the bad things that he's going to do. And then the use of like Christmas lights, the way people are getting in and out of the house in the chase scenes, jumping up out of vans, going through windows. And then the pitch perfect ending of the film, which I won't spoil exactly, but we're with one character and all the crazy boys are gone. Like all the violent proto men are wiped away. And we're just with this one scarred, you know, survivor with this really unique scar on the back of her neck, just looking face forward into her future, trying to put her life back together and learn things and move on. And it's just such a great visual, there's a podcast that The Ringer is doing, a podcast series that I envy. I wish I had thought of it, called Did They Stick the Landing? And they review the final episode of TV series to see if they stuck the landing. Like, did they end the series well? Like Game of Thrones would be the example of not, right? But Super Dark Times stuck the landing. Okay, I'm going to kind of hate myself for doing this, but because this movie is ridiculous. But it's also Tubi, and that's part of the fun of Tubi. It can't all be a string of masterpieces. So fuck it. I'm going to go with Hammer's 1972 film Twins of Evil, starring Peter Cushing and Madeline and Mary Collinson as the twins. So this movie is gloriously a hot mess. Like, it's great. I mean, I think it's great. I actually think it's really well executed in a lot of parts. It's just so over the top on the nose in parts and weirdly repetitive for no reason, where we keep having to see the same characters' gravestones or hear the characters reiterate the same lines. I mean, they really want us to get across that Count Karnstein is a Satanist by having him tell us he's a Satanist, do every meal with a toast, Hail Satan, Hail Sataning all over the place. I mean, I'm surprised he's not wearing a shirt saying, I'm with Satan. Like, it's not subtle. There's a scene where one of the characters is being seduced by Karnstein, and she's like doing a very suggestive hand motion on a candlestick, which is just like unmistakable what's going on there. I mean, this movie is not hiding what it's about, but it's actually really kind of surprisingly brutal in parts. It opens with a witch hunt and a burning on a cross or at a stake kind of thing. And then the credits, the opening credits are rolling over this scene while someone's getting cooked alive. And it's just like casual cruelty from the movie, which is just kind of a bizarre, but in the spirit of what this movie is going to be, Peter Cushing is predictably phenomenal in this part as a completely ruthless witch hunter who starts to get a little softened or more sympathetic towards the end of the movie when it's way too late, but definitely deserves an absolutely awful fate. The Count Karnstein character is unbelievably over the top and absurd and not even frightening for a second, but that's okay because there are two things that are really frightening in this film. And the first thing is the bad twin of the twins of evil, because of course one is a super evil twin and one is, you know, a virginal, you know, great twin. And the scary twin, Frida, is scary. She would be a really effective vampire, especially on men of that time. But the other thing is just the random cruelty of the system that the poor people in this, you know, village and presumably across the land are having to deal with, because it's not just vampires roaming the woods and roaming the night hunting for victims. It's also the aristocracy. Count Karnstein is sending out his servant to go kidnap people and bring them to his lair. And then you've got the witch hunters who are roving around in wolf packs, who are trying, because people are turning up dead with, you know, two holes in their necks. They like, and I hate to say this because their response is completely wrong, but their premise is right. Like, the devil is stalking their town. So, but they have the absolute like worst possible response to it, which is to blame the victim. And then they're thinking, well, you know, the devil must be possessing women to, you know, seduce people into the woods and kill them. So they're trying to find women who, of course, are, you know, like whether they're unorthodox in some way or not married or they have a voice of their own or any other manner of things that the misogyny of the time would be triggered by. They will snatch them up. There's a scene where they see a woman just going down like a path in the woods carrying a basket of fruit, just like trying to bring some fucking fruit home to her family or whatever. And they're like, get her. And then they just ride, sweep her up onto the horses and go burn her in like, you know, half a minute. It's like unbelievable. So everything is victimizing the people of this town. It's the elites are killing them. The witch hunting pack of people is killing them. The vampires are killing them. Nature is killing them. There's nowhere to turn in this fucking place. Now, this could have just been an exploitative, like, twinsploitation kind of movie, and it is in a couple of ways, but it's way above grade of that material in a lot of other ways, not just by Peter Cushing, but, and I hate to have discovered that the Collinson twins were dubbed in this film for some reason, but even without that, just by their body language, for people who had no training at acting at all, they're really credible and surprisingly good as the characters that aren't written with any kind of depth or nuance. I mean, one's like, one wears white and she's good, and the other one, you know, wears, you know, bright red and she's bad. But just to give you an example of how it's above, it's a better movie than it had a right to be, or you would expect from something called The Twins of Evil. And by the way, the title drop from Peter Cushing in this movie is one of my favorite title drops. I'm not going to tell you where it is, but oh my God, the title drop in this movie, I was tearing up from how hilarious it was. But I'll give an example of the quality spots of this movie. There's a moment where there's a peasant girl being tortured for his amusement by Count Karnstein. And he is, well, before he's torturing her, he's just like toying with her at a dinner in his castle. And Frida, the evil twin, is there with him. And it becomes clear from what he's saying that he intends to torture this poor peasant girl. And he asks or looks over and he's trying to see, is Frida into this? And the camera swivels around so that you're looking at the peasant girl in between them. And then you're looking at Karstein, who is supposedly the most evil, depraved person in the room right now. And then the camera floats over to the twin. And the look on her face is way more chilling on Karstein's. And you realize that she's going to be a way scarier villain than he's going to be, ultimately. But that kind of switch from a person that you've been hanging out with her sister, as you kind of get introduced to them in the beginning of the movie, and you're like rooting for both of them. And then to see that the inner Charlie Manson in this person just like bubble over and come out all at once in this scene is visually really good, and is very good acting on her part. But I'm not gonna lie to you, this movie is not a masterpiece. This is, to me, one of the so flawed it's good kind of movies. But oh my god, it's so much fun. Now the last movie is My Heart Can't Beat Unless You Tell It To. I want to credit Darren Ramsey, who voted for this in the poll on our page. This is a 2021 movie directed by Jonathan Quartus. This is, unlike Twins of Evil, this is a masterpiece. It's a slow burn for sure. It's sneaky because I think no one's told you, but if you haven't seen this movie and you're a fan of Let the Right One In, this is a sneaky remake. I mean, I'm saying that as a joke because it's not a remake and it's, you know, not the same really in a lot of ways. But it's the only movie I've seen, or at least American movie that I've seen, that gives me that original Let the Right One In kind of vibes. And I know I'm setting the bar really high here because that's one of the best horror movies ever made. And this is a great movie. Don't get me wrong. My Heart Can't Beat is really, really well done. But it's not as good as Let the Right One In, let's be clear. But it's to even be the one evocative of that is quite an achievement. It's a vampire movie in kind of unexpected ways. And I don't really want to spoil this movie at all, even though it's not that plot heavy. But so I'm not going to talk about it in depth. I just like go in not knowing anything if you don't know it now. If you have a tolerance for slow burn horror, not that nothing happens here because there are some brutal scenes, but it's not paced like this isn't Aliens. But I think that this is one of those few movies that, like, It Follows, for example, which I know probably just made a lot of you mad for me saying it, is a movie that just grew and grew in my head over time and kind of got a grip on me and wouldn't let go. To tell you the truth, the other spiritual relative of this movie, at least in terms of the reaction it kind of got out of me, is Bones and All. So if you were a Bones and All fan and you haven't seen My Heart Can't Beat Unless You Tell It To, by all means, go find this film. I also want to give you some of the community choices. David Joshua Smith, who is incredibly perceptive, as always, commented as his vote, "Thanks to Horror Weekly, there are a bunch of gems that you've steered in my direction, like Burning Bright and Spellbinder, Manic Movie Monday podcast." Yes, my favorite podcast. Showed me Hello Mary Lou, Prom Night 2, and Lisa. But my favorite discovery was this gem that Guillermo del Toro produced called Julia's Eyes, which had some jaw-dropping moments and genuine tension. Kat Savio voted Cannibal Apocalypse, starring John Saxon, and said, "Not a good movie, but I enjoy it." Jamie Bai just dropped a picture, just a legendary picture from Hell Comes to Frogtown. And if you haven't seen Hell Comes to Frogtown, fix that. There were some votes for the 2015 werewolf movie called Howl. Jada Josette voted for Assassination Nation. And Cindy Grattan-Patris, who is a direct supporter of this page. Thank you so much, Cindy. Voted for Cat O' Nine Tails. So there you have it. The question I had asked the group was, what's an obscure horror movie that you enjoyed watching on Tubi? I'm calling this Tubi Horror Treasures. So though this is collectively between those picks that I just gave you from them and mine, our treasure trove of Tubi horror gems. I randomly have access to Fubo for the moment, so I'm going to watch a movie that I recorded on there called Starfish, which is an apocalyptic horror thriller, it looks like. I know nothing going into it, except for it looks really intriguing, so this may be coming up in a future episode. If you've seen it and you like it or don't like it or whatever, you can let me know about it by messaging the Horror Weekly Facebook page or tagging us in Threads. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for subscribing and dropping reviews if you had. They mean the world to me. And thank you to everybody who commented and participated. That you all make this podcast what it is. And thank you to the rogue like Horror Weekly subscribers who wrote us in for the Rondo Hatton Awards. I really appreciate your efforts. Okay, that's it. I'm off to Starfish. Until next Thursday, have a great Horror Week.